para su baño.
Welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio today, which is really wonderful, by the star-studded cast of actors from A Soldier's Play, which is currently on stage in San Francisco. One of our first guests to join us was Kari.
Boy.
Yeah, Kari Boy. I want to say Moye, because has anyone ever pronounced your name Moye?
Yes, they have. They see the E at the end of Moy and just decide to run with it a little bit, but that's okay. My mama gave me a different name for a reason.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because there's a really famous drummer from the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and his name is Famadou Don Moye. And,
nice.
Yeah, when I saw your name, it was like, Kari. And I just like went Moye and then Moye. Okay, right. Cool. And who else do we have in the studio? Is that Abby or is it?
Gift.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Gift Kara.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Gift. Okay, super. Yeah, when I saw your face, like, oh, I know him.
That's right, Mr. Wilkie.
Yeah. And, let's see, and I think we have one other person in the studio. Who else is that? So we have Gift, we have Kari. Who else is that?
Michael.
Mike? Oh, you got up. Super. Oh, that's
yeah, nice. Bad Sergeant War.
Wow.
You know, there's a great line in the play where I tell the guys to get up because the shooting has just occurred and everybody's just waking up.
I could use you this there. Morning, brother.
Yeah, I come in there waking everybody up. Let's go. Let's get up.
Oh, that's funny.
All right, wake them, Wilkie.
Wake them, Wilkie.
Yeah.
All right. So
there's a fourth caller. I don't know if you're just listening or if you're a part of the cast. So before I go on, is there a fourth member of the cast on the air?
I think Dewan Connor is supposed to be calling in as well.
Okay. Is that Dewan then? No? Okay.
He may not be with us. He may be turning over right now, just getting away.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, well, Kari, I mean, it's really interesting that, you know, you hail from New York, and now you're all the way across the country, you know, on the West Coast, and you've been performing a whole lot since you've been here.
Yes.
You've been really, really busy. I mean, you've got, you know, film, television, you know, background, along with, you know, a lot of theater. And you know, and now you're in a Soldier's Story. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about your character, James Wilkie, Sergeant James Wilkie, no, Private James Wilkie,
used to be a sergeant before he got caught drunk on the base and Sergeant Waters took his stripes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, I made a mistake. That's Gift Harris's character. Sorry.
Yes, that's Mr. Gift.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should just read your bios. Dick Harris has worked on stage at many Bay Area theaters, including the Lorraine Hansberry, where he did two productions, Dream on Monkey's Mountain and Living Fat. Other stages where Giff has performed include the Marin Theatre Company, Drama Studio in London, Berkeley with the Berkeley Repertory School Touring Company. His stage credits include Fences, Master Harold and the Boys, Miss Julie, As You Like It, and Midsummer Night's Dream by Shakespeare. He has also toured the United States and Europe with various stage productions. One of the productions in Europe premiered a show at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. His TV and scene credits include Weeds, Midnight Caller, and he most recently starred in an episode of Discovery ID, Cuff Me If You Can. He can also be seen in the upcoming independent film, Green Bandits, being released later this year by Scary Cow Productions. He's also, Giff has worked at schools around the Bay Area as an artist in the schools. He was able to share his love of acting with kids and teens of all ages and backgrounds. And then Michael Lange, you didn't send me a bio, but when I first met you, you were working for the Parks and Rec, and you were organizing, you were in charge of the Oakland's Feather River camp, and you were sort of like the coordinator of all the activities, and you would come up in as Slim, and you play your guitar and sing songs and things like that, which was really cool. And then also you actually started an independent theater. What's the name of the theater that you started more recently?
Yeah, it was called Bay Art, Bay Area Repertory Theater.
Right, yeah. And you've acted, but you've also directed, and I remember I had you on the air a few times, but I think the last time was about this film that was set in Nigeria about the oil. It was Eastern Nigeria, and you were, did you direct that film?
Yes, I directed a marvelous film, and it was a wonderful group of Nigerians located here in the Bay Area. We shot over a 2.5-week period, and the beauty of that film was they were not anywhere near afraid of that camera. I had that camera right on their knuckles in certain scenes and close-ups, and they just went right into it. What a beautiful film that was.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And well, you're a professor. Africa Rise, right. That was a really good film. It was a part of the Oakland International Film mm-hmm. Festival. I guess that must have been 2010.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And you're also a professor. You teach at San Jose State, and what's the name of your class or seminar you teach?
I've taught many classes there now after 15 years, but the class I'm teaching now for seniors that are graduating from San Jose State, they write in their major, and they solve a problem. So they stay on one problem the entire semester and learn how to research it, how to do the citations, the quotations, the paraphrasing, so that they become an army of one. They know exactly how to solve this issue as a researcher, not as an opinionated, this is what I'd like to see, but this is the facts, just the facts.
Nice, yeah. Wow, that's great. So, Kari, why don't you tell us about this play? What's it about?
A Soldier's Play is basically my character, Captain Richard Davenport, is sent in to investigate a murder on an Army base back in the 1940s when segregation was really prevalent. And so, you know, I feel like my character has to jump through a lot of hoops, more so than normal, because no one is used to seeing this educated, well-spoken African-American man with these bars walking around telling everybody what to do and doing what he asks, whether they're African-American or Caucasian. And his whole thing is just, I just want to solve this murder, and I want to find out who did it and why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Charles Fuller wrote this play, and it's a real classic. On stage, it's been performed by, you know, some of the best actors in the field, and then the film. Oh my goodness! I mean,
The play had Denzel, the film had Denzel, and the film had, which I had big shoes to follow, Mr. Howard Rollins, may he rest in peace.
Yeah.
I think Michael was funny. I think he told me that a lot of times people will ask, like, who's playing whose character, and instead of they were like, oh, who's playing Howard Rollins? Like, it wasn't who's playing Davenport. Who's playing
Howard's
role? So, I had to step my game up to, you know, really make sure that I did the character justice, and I worked really hard to do so. I mean, I definitely didn't try to emulate what he did. I just wanted to do the best I could do and put my spin on it, and I think it works.
Mm-hmm.
It does work, yeah. And a good friend of mine who was here in Berkeley played the role of Wilkie in the motion picture. And I didn't get a chance to see the film, but I know the gentleman who did it. And then, of course, on stage, it was Stephen Anthony Jones who played that role.
Mm-hmm.
Who's
wow.
now over at the Lorraine Hansberry. Okay.
Yeah, he's with the Lorraine Hansberry now, yeah.
Yeah,
so.
Artistic director. Yeah.
Art Evans played it on the film. So, you know, we have wonderful images to look up to. Not that we're trying to reproduce them. This is our unique interpretation of it because of the person who plays each of these roles, and we're trying to bring our A game, and I think we're finding that as how we're doing it. So we're going to have a big party afterward, and we're going to watch the film.
Yeah, we really are. We are going to have a little cast party afterwards for those who have not seen the film and finally have a chance to sit back and watch the movie and just enjoy and just remember the experiences we've had together these last couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because your play has been up for a while. It's been up since September 28th, and it's going for another couple of weeks through October 21st at the, what's the name of that theater in Fort Mill? Fort Mason Center's Southside Theater. Really nice, intimate venue. And
yeah.
Your performances are 8 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays and 3 p.m. on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And people can call 510-213-0401, 510-213-0401. So this play written by Charles Fuller is about the murder investigation of an African-American non-commissioned officer in the United States Army and an exploration of how racism influences behaviors and ideals. So in this particular version of the play, the all of the actors are African-American, right?
Yes.
No, a couple of characters who are there's some Caucasian, you know, white characters in it too, and they played some of the captains who were on the base and being investigated as well. So you get that perspective too, and just, you know, again, remembering that this is in 1940s, you know, you get the perspective of what was going on in World War II and just the race relationships at that time.
Right, yeah. So, Gift, your character, you write, is a military man, a career military man, who has his stripes taken away by the not-so-nice Sergeant Waters. And I don't know Sergeant Waters. You have to tell us about him. And and your character works towards getting his stripes back by doing a lot of extra things for the sergeant. And and he's the only your character's the only man in the company who's married and has children besides Sergeant Waters. So you have a few things in common besides the rank, I suppose. And it says Wilkie you were a sergeant. Okay, so you appeared.
Yeah.
Before your stripes were taken away. So who is this Sergeant Waters? Why did Wilkie lose his stripes, and how did he get them back? Was it above board?
Well, here's the thing. Basically, Sergeant Waters came in to help the fellas who all basically were baseball. They were a baseball team. They came from the Negro League, and so the Army just put all of them together. And at that time, they weren't being used to do, like, any of the military stuff or fight or whatever. They were basically just like the cleanup crews and, you know, doing the menial work around the base. So they bring in Sergeant Waters to kind of help get us together. He was, you know, just gunnery sergeant, whatever. So So not too long after he's gotten there, you know, he catches me one day. I'm drunk, and, you know, granted that. But then he takes all my stripes and puts me in jail, too. So it's like it totally didn't fit the crime. But so now I play this game of, like, you know, basically kissing his butt to try to, you know, get my stripes back. And we go through a lot of, you know, I basically help him and his assistant or whatever and help manage the team. And at toward the end, it's going to be a nice little twist to it. But basically, he has me do something that's like a bribe, and he says, like, you know, if you do this, I'm going to give you your stripes back. And it kind of like a nice little twist in the play, too. So I feel like basically, you know, I'm the person who's, like, closest in age to Waters, like, you know, late 30s, early 40s. And in spite of losing my rank or whatever, I basically don't try to hold a grudge against him, you know. You know, so basically throughout the play, I pretty much, you know, play this little game with him. And through the interviews, we learn a lot about the sergeant, you know, through me. I'm the first person that, you know, Captain Davenport, you know, Kari's character, I'm the first person that he interviews. And you start getting information that, like, oh, okay, this is who this sergeant is, blah, blah, blah. But then later on, when I'm interviewed, you hear, you know, a different take on it. So it's kind of like interesting way Charles Fuller put this together, because basically we learn a lot about Michael's character, the sergeant, through these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
In flashback form, basically. So we, you know, he interviews us, and then we start unfolds on what happened to the sergeant. And basically, you know, you get a lot of different takes on who he really was. You know, so was he this character who was really nice and sometimes fair to his men, or is he this a-hole? I don't know if I could say, you know, ass on her.
No, you were right to say it the other way.
I scratched that first part.
too late. Scratch it.
Oh, that will be.
Yeah. Can we say white boys, too?
Interesting.
That's what I have, a lot of lines about the white boys that are in this production. They are great. For them to have stood up and take this script and deliver the character is unbelievable. So our director and our assistant director, Gerald Wright, who you probably know quite well, Gerald, we were going over the lines in the play, and he says, don't emphasize the bad words. Just walk right through it. This is how we do it in the military. So we would, rather than emphasize a nasty or bad or cuss word, whatever you want to call it, we would just walk right over the top of it as if it hadn't even been there.
Right, yeah. Interesting. So Michael, is your character, this character that's opposite Gift's character who loses, is your character the one that takes his stripes?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
First act
yeah.
that I do is to take his stripes.
Uh huh. So you know, given sort of the dynamics, you know, around power and race, which is, you know, and then you know, you look at the military, it's like a closed society, even though it's a part of the American society, it's almost like its own entity. What is your character's thinking around that? Is he trying to get in with the other folks? You know, does he relish in being able to demean and subdue his colleague? Because, yeah, I mean, what does he enjoy this?
Yeah. Okay, that's a very good question. I think a lot of Sergeant Waters goes back to his childhood. Because in the script he mentions his father several times and how his father raised him, told him where not to live, told him how to say this versus that, you know, things like that. So he's from the North, apparently, but he also may be from the South. We don't quite know where he was born at or where his father was born. So he's growing up and he's gotten these experiences that he has locked in his imagination and believes them. to a proverb. I mean, he is mean-spirited, I guess, is the closest word that I can come to with regard to the differences between the African-Americans from the South versus the African-Americans from the North. So there's a kind of a mix in there, and he doesn't like folk who come from the South, even though he himself is black. He doesn't like black folk from the South, and so that's his conflict that we see come out, and we see it at different angles from the different testimonies that we hear.
Wow. So he dislikes himself.
He dislikes himself. He says, you got to be like them. And them, of course, would be the power structure, the white power structure. Mm-hmm. And then he says, and I was. So that's, to me, the telling moment that the CJ, who he picks on, is a big, beautiful, wonderful human spirit, but he picks on him because he can. And, you know, our CJ is a big fella. He's over 250 pounds, and I make him hit me. And he hits me, and that's exactly what I want. I want to get rid of another one. And I start talking about the Geechies and what they called them back in 1943. I got three Geechies here, I got two Geechies there, and now I got you. So the issue is with power, and it is with race, but it's within the race. And we still have some of these issues today. I'm sure it's out there. And it was tough for me to try to grasp this character because my personality and my world experience is somewhat opposite of that, but I am fair-skinned. Mm-hmm. I have grown up. I have been called the N-word. I look around and I see, but somehow I made it through the quagmire. But the Sergeant Waters of the world, who were probably born in the late 1800s, gone through World War One, is now in World War Two, is ready to retire and to raise his children, all of this looking forward to it. He still has this childhood memory that's strong, even though now he's probably 55 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that brings, in that sort of the politics of color in the African-American community and all the stuff that carries with it. Even though what I'm reading is that that CJ is, really sort of lighthearted and
yeah.
fun. Whereas, whereas Sergeant Waters, he's like really conflicted and tortured, a tortured soul that takes it out on his men.
Yes, all those things are true. He takes a lot of stuff on his men. I just wanted to also throw out some of the names of some of the other people in there. CJ Memphis. That character is played by Lamont Young.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of, this is a really good ensemble piece, as mm-hmm. somebody stated earlier. You got a lot of, just wonderful cast members. You got Orlando Graves and Lamont Jones, like I said, who plays CJ. Dewan, who's also a producer, Dewan Conner, he's playing Denzel Washington's character, Private Peterson. So you got, John Lowell, you got Keita Jones, you got, Orlando Graves, and you got a lot of just wonderful characters in here. So definitely people should definitely come out because they'll see like a whole ensemble of, wonderful cast members.
Yeah, so who plays Big Mary? Because Patti LaBelle played Big Mary in the film.
You know what? They added her character in for the film.
Oh.
In the play version of those of this production, there isn't that character.
No women, okay.
Yeah, it's also all male cast.
All men, yeah, real powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't know. I thought it did, but I didn't realize that Charles Fuller's he got the Pulitzer Prize for this production.
Yeah.
It was on Broadway too. Back in 1984.
Around 83 or 84. I know the play was written around 82 or 83, so it would be right about then.
82, okay. Yeah, that is awesome. So does anyone know anything about Charles Fuller? Has he written anything else?
He wrote a couple of good things. He wrote, what's that other play? He wrote one about this You know what? Let me think about it for a minute, because he wrote a couple of other really good plays.
And I did know, he wrote 5 on the Black Hand Side, I believe.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a beautiful
nice.
Production. Yeah.
Is he still with us?
Yeah, he's still living.
Okay.
Yeah, probably in Philadelphia.
Okay. Nice. Excellent. So, Kari, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about sort of, Captain Davenport coming into this. You know, this is like, I mean, even if there hadn't been a murder, it would have been something. So, when he steps into this world, what are his initial perceptions? And also, and I was wondering, in your career, what prepared you for this role, to step into this history that is not history like its past, but it's history like its present? Because, look at the military and how every time we turn around, there's new legislation around this or new legislation around that, trying to make things equitable for all enlisted men and women.
As far as my character, I just really felt like, for one, he understands that he was only sent in because, one, the case was considered a low priority. Second, they send him in because, in their mind, he understands blacks better. So they don't necessarily really care about an outcome, whether it's positive or negative. They just want to shut people up. And so they send my character in. I want to know what happened, and I care about what happened as a black man going to a colored facility. And, the minute he gets there, his liaison is a Caucasian captain, and right off the bat, you can tell that things are just not going to go as well as they should within that first interaction that they have. And my character always feels like he has something to prove.
Mm-hmm.
He has a chip on his shoulder, and rightly so. You have this gentleman who studied law at Howard University, very well-spoken, well-read, well-versed. And for all of that, to everyone else, he's just another N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel like you never get any justification. You don't get any merit for what you have done. And so the satisfaction has to come within yourself, because you're not going to get it from anybody else. Even from the other privates, some look up to him like, it really is good to see one of us wearing those captain's bars. And others are kind of looking at him like, I don't know, you seem like you might be an Uncle Tom, because you're not like us. You don't speak like us. You don't dress like us. You don't.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it was... It must have been interesting being a Richard Davenport back then and kind of trying to find your niche as far as, like, where you fit in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as far as how I prepared for it, I've just the only real experience I've had as far as, like, really feeling like race was an issue was probably when I was going to New Utrecht High School in New York. Because I grew up in New York, lived there for over 30-something years before I finally moved out to the Bay Area. And in New Utrecht back then, it was an Italian neighborhood, and they really wasn't feeling us then. Like, we all would leave together at the end of school in big groups, because that's how we felt the safest, and we all took a train together. No one ever left on their own. And there's been times where they would be waiting for us at the pizzeria with bats and calling us the N-word and stuff. And I remember what that was like. And that's why I didn't even stay that long. I stayed for maybe a year. And then I transferred to another school in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a sample. I mean, it was nothing like it was back in the 40s. And I'm talking about when this happened, this was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 40s. Back when everything was segregated, back when we had to use our own water fountains in our own bathrooms,
mm-hmm.
I can imagine how it was back then. Where if you looked at a white woman, you might get shot.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So in the end, with your character, Does he sort of come to some kind of resolution or some kind of sort of peace within himself around, you know, these stirring waters that he's navigating, and after he does his job, does he sort of walk off in a different, with a different type of move, a different type of step than when he entered the base?
Well, just to make sure I'm not giving away anything, but I will just say that he's not satisfied.
Oh, he's not? Oh, okay.
He's not satisfied.
Yeah.
It's a shame. Mm-hmm. And it's at least with my character, I have like three very long monologues, but I also feel like my character is the narrator of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
I begin by catching the audience up on what's been going on, and I check in again in the middle, and at the end I have like my closing argument as the lawyer / narrator of the story.
Uh-huh.
And,
right.
Yeah, I would have to say without a doubt that Captain Davenport is just not satisfied with whatever happens at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, closing our conversation, which has been really enlightening, I was wondering, you know, when we think about a soldier's play and we bring it into the 21st century and we, you know, 2012, what are some of the relevance, you know, obvious relevance and maybe not so obvious when one thinks about this story that, you know, must have a lot of truth to it because it keeps on being performed and audiences are just as taken with it, you know, if they've seen the movie or if this is their first encounter with this particular story. So what makes it so, what keeps the story so present with us? And, you know, whether it's from the military aspect or it's from the relationship between the men or we're looking at sort of race and American culture. So what makes it, I guess, topical right now? In October 2012.
I think one of the things I think it works with is that it's an important link to the past, in particular World War II. But, of course, we've been in everything from the revolution of this country to the Civil War to World War I and II, the conflicts current. But what's happening here is that a lot of history has been left out, particularly on the silver screen. So whether you're watching Private Ryan and not know exactly what role African-Americans played in that, the double victory, the victory abroad in Europe, if we can get the victory there, we should be able to get the victory here. And that's what the double V stood for.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some issues around justice coming due. And Captain Davenport, you know, you call that justice. Even within the black community, there are still prescient issues that we have to deal with, and one of them has to deal with our worldview of who we are. We are Africans in America,
mm-hmm.
not African-Americans. You can argue that point, but our connection to our motherland is not present in any of the wars that we've been in. We've wanted to become hyphenated African-Americans in this country. So there's a lot of conflict going on in these characters because who am I? Am I Opaku or Yuletse Kofi? That's my heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But I've lost all that. I'm now Jones. I'm now Waters. I'm now CJ. I'm all of these new things. And so we still have a lot of that going on to talk about in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's gone on is that, you know, you have to remember the military has been one of the things that has been an equal opportunity employer of blacks for like a lot of years, but we, like Michael said, we didn't never really get to our due. So whether it's the Tuskegee Airmen or, you know, the Buffalo Soldiers, in every war, we basically fought in those wars to try to make things better for us, like in our lives, you know, when we come back. And for, you know, the country at large. So I think that's what we still pretty much struggle with, is that, you know, we wanted to always show what we could do. And it's only through our persistence that, you know, we've been able to really show, like, oh, okay, not only are they good, they're really good. So, you know, that's one of the things that really people get out of it, that, you know, black people have always had to, like, work harder. That's when you have a Davenport, you really do feel good, because he's a captain. And at that time, that's, like, such a rare situation that, you know, it just puts it all in context. Like, wow, okay, yeah, we are able to do that. So my character in general really appreciates, like, you know, seeing a captain there. So I think that's one of the things people get from it. And I also just wanted to say about Charles Fuller, that other play I was talking about was called Zoo Man and the Sign.
Oh,
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
And then, Lorraine Hansberry did that one, too.
They sure did.
Well, back a while back. And then, so that one, and then right after that, that's when Charles Fuller wrote A Soldier Story. And then it went on Broadway in 82. But I think people are going to really kind of get a chance to not only hear some wonderful writing and in this play, but also kind of like just to see a storyline that really kind of like keeps you kind of hooked in there. And like I said, the wonderful ensemble cast that we have just really kind of like puts a lot of energy and heart into it. And we've also actually enjoyed, you know, working together as an ensemble. So definitely people come out and see it.
Okay, cool, super. Yeah, and again, the play, it runs through the 21st, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, right? 8 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, and Sunday at 3.
Yeah.
At the Southside Theater at the Fort Mason Center.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's Building D. That's right next to the Magic Theater, so they'll definitely be able to find it in there.
Okay, cool, super. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and looking forward to seeing you all on stage.
Well, thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care. Oh, you're welcome.
Have a good morning.
Okay, you too. Peace and blessings.
Peace and love. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Go Queen Linda.
Hambone, the way you been. Round the corner and back again. Hambone, where you was. In the kitchen cooking rice.
Hambone.
Give me hambone. Give me some hambone. Well now, hambone, put him on your shoulder. If you get a pretty girl, I'll show you how to hold her. Hambone, where you been. All around the world and back again. Hambone.
Hambone, what you gonna do? Got in a train and my fella flew.
Hambone,
where did you go?
Miss Lucy,
would you marry me? Well, I don't care if Papa don't care. Hambone.
Baba to the bone,
to the left.
I take a stick.
And if that's the one you broke, mama gonna buy me a billy door. But if that billy don't go wrong, mama gonna buy me a BB gun. And if that baby gun don't shoot, mama gonna buy me a swimming suit. But if someone won't get on me, mama gonna whip my BB. Hambone, the hambone.
Your film, Barbara, the Barbara Birmingham, and congratulations on the Academy Award nomination. That's really exciting.
It's so exciting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so how does that work? When do they let you know?
Let us know what?
The Academy, so you got nominated. Did you win it?
Oh, no. So the awards are on February 26th.
Oh, okay. It's coming up.
Yeah.
Oh, so, nice.
Yeah. So that's when I go to the awards and find out then.
Oh, wow. So that would be so cool. So you'll be sitting in the audience and they'll be, you know, panning the audience when they come to your category and we'll look at your face and see anticipation and all that.
Yes, and I'll be there with actually my co-director Gail Dilgen's daughter will be going with me along with her husband. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So tell me about you and co-director's journey to Birmingham and how you met the subject of the film, Mr. Armstrong.
Right. So. This is my first film.
Oh, seriously? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a good way to start.
Yeah,
wow. Like right at the top, you get nominated. Oh, my goodness. That is hot. Wow.
Yes.
Wow. You already got an Oscar, right?
You know, it's just unbelievable to have made it this far. It's pretty amazing and exciting. But, so I'm a... My background's in photography, so I had been working as a photographer, and back before the election of 2008, before Obama was nominated, I just started to really think about the people who brought us to this day and try to imagine what they must be feeling for those who possibly the right to vote and were alive to see even the possible nomination of the first African-American president. And, you know, I just was here in the Bay Area, but thinking that it was such an important moment in history, and in particular from through the perspective of the, like I said, those who were the foot soldiers who really fought for these rights and paved the way and were not the ones that we hear most about. We hear about the leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, but most of us have not heard about the foot soldiers, and they were those who carried out the, the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King and the teachings, the nonviolent teachings, but they were the people who risked their lives and their livelihoods for these rights. And so I decided to take a trip to Birmingham to do some research, and I felt that this would make a very compelling documentary and that this history needed to be recorded. And so I went to Birmingham just to do research and meet people and start talking to foot soldiers. And I was immediately put in touch with Shirley Floyd, who worked at an organization called the Civil Rights Activist Committee, and they were, that was known in Birmingham as the home of the foot soldiers, and it was really a place for the foot soldiers to go and tell their stories, and Shirley had spent the last 11 years documenting these stories, and she had a newsletter that came out and really just capturing the stories of the foot soldiers. So somebody put me in touch with her right away, and she was very instrumental in helping connect me with a lot of people in Birmingham. But then somebody else said to me, "Have you met the barber?" And so I took a trip to Mr. Armstrong's barber shop to meet him, and immediately saw him, and he was wearing his plaid pants and his bow tie and his bright yellow shirt and his hat and had this great big smile, and he invited me to come into his shop, and I looked around and saw every inch of space covered with memorabilia from the civil rights movement. And then I ended up just sitting for hours in his chair listening to him tell his own personal stories of his involvement in the movement and how he integrated his kids into the all-white elementary school, Greymount Elementary School, and he was the flag bearer who carried the original flag on Bloody Sunday and the march from Selma to Montgomery, and he was the first black family to move into an all-white neighborhood, and I had a guard that had to sit on their front doorstep because they had bomb threats and their dog was poisoned. And
oh my goodness!
Just
really?
Hearing of his how he had dedicated his whole life and the sacrifices that he and his family made for to better this country, and I decided it was through Mr. Armstrong's eyes that this story should be told, that he represented all of the thousands of foot soldiers who made a difference. And so, but I still didn't know how to make a film. And then I came back to the Bay Area, and by this time now, Obama had been nominated. We were getting closer to the election, and I knew that it was a critical time to be able to film, and it was ironically through a hairdresser who introduced me and Gail together.
Really?
And Gail was an award-winning documentary filmmaker and just extremely talented. And so Gail and I met, and I sent Gail pictures of Mr. Armstrong and a little description of him and some of the foot soldiers and the ideas that I had, and Gail loved it, and she saw a great story here. And so 2 weeks later, Gail and I were off and shooting the election, and we ended up filming during that whole year, what ended up being the last year of Mr. Armstrong's life. We filmed him from November of 08 till November of 09 when he passed away. And then Gail and I continued to work on the film, and then she passed away after a long battle with breast cancer. She passed away in October of 2010.
Wow.
And at that point is when our executive producers, Chicken and Egg Pictures, and co-producer Judith Helfand came on in the project and really helped to finish the film and we submitted it to Sundance. Actually, just days before Gail passed away, we decided to send the sample that we had created. We sent it to Sundance and found out we were accepted. So a whole community of people who worked with Gail in Berkeley
mm-hmm.
all came together, and they helped me finish this project and get it to Sundance and bring it to where it is today.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? What a journey. And, you know,
yeah.
Mr. Armstrong, you know, he has a barbershop, and you meet Gail via, you know,
hairdresser.
A hairdresser. That is, wow, that is so amazing. And
Gail,
when I was, yeah, go
was
ahead.
To me, it was a good example of the power of the barbershop, which was used so much. Like, Mr. Armstrong had his barbershop since 1950, and it was really, and I think it is, especially in the Black community, it's a hub for, passing of information, and
mm-hmm.
it was used that way, especially during the Civil Rights Movement, and, I mean, Mr. Armstrong, that's where he used that barber chair to educate. Like, even the day, I remember even on Election Day, Gail and I were there,
mm-hmm.
and if you walked in and if you didn't have your sticker on, he told you to go back out and vote and then come back for your haircut. I mean, he really used his barbershop to educate everybody who sat in that chair about the Civil Rights Movement. And it was interesting because I met Gail, had been talking to the hairdresser who happened to be the daughter of a good friend of mine, and Gail was talking about another project she was working on and which was in Alabama, and things weren't going so well, and so she was telling the hairdresser, and it triggered in Danny. Danny said, oh, my gosh, you know, my mom has a friend with this idea, and she's looking for a filmmaker, and I want to introduce you. So it was, again, like the power of this communication that gets passed along through the barbershop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and beauty parlor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm beauty parlor, right.
Oh, that is so fascinating. I was just looking at, some of the films that Gail Dogan directed, and I know her daughter from Da Nang, from a long time ago. It won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary, and it was nominated for Academy Award. I'm like, wow, she did that one? And then I remember Forever Activist Stories of Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And I was like, wow, so it's, you know, this particular project of documenting, you know, the foot soldiers of the Civil Rights Movement was, you know, sort of right thematically, you know, up her alley, so to speak.
Well, I think all of her films, and not only her films, but in her life, I think that she always fought for social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she chose her films carefully, you know, for that reason, because, and it is, and in our, in this particular film, in the Barbara Birmingham, she knew that this was going to be her last project. She was in the late stages of cancer when I met her, and she knew she only had so much time and energy, and she wanted it to be something that she felt very passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
She did, and she did towards about this film.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then also Mr. Armstrong's wife, she made her transition in 2010 too, right?
Mr. Armstrong's
wife?
His wife?
Yeah, I thought when I was reading the closing credits.
No, Mr. Armstrong's wife, well, there was more than one, but the one who was the mother of his four children
mm-hmm.
had died when the children were fairly young.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because I thought as it was rolling, I know he passed, and then I thought I saw that his wife had too. And I was like, oh, she died like not
no,
long after.
I think that was Gail's name under his.
Oh, that was Gail. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was reading you know, about you, and it says, you know, that, that your photographic image, you're known for your photography of children, and that you're really committed to using your work to help underprivileged children. And I was wondering I don't know if you start an organization for foster adoptive families, the Bay Area Heart Gallery. Tell me about the Bay Area Heart Gallery.
Yeah, so that's an organization that was founded by myself and Freddie Juni, and it was actually Freddie's daughter who introduced me to Gail. So it all, you know, small world.
Mm.
Freddie and I started this project. It's been going for a number of years in the Bay Area here, but it's also, they have heart galleries throughout the country. It was originally started by somebody in New Mexico, and it's a collaboration between social services and photographers who photograph children who are in need of foster homes or permanent adoption, or we focus a lot on older youth who are aging out of the system and may just want a permanent connection with a family. You know, they're aging out and they don't have a family to spend the holidays with, or just somebody who's there to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times, like, you see the photographs that are done through social services are, you know, kind of mugshots. They really don't portray the children in as they are. And so we work with a number of photographers, professional photographers, and put on an exhibit that travels all over the Bay Area. And so Freddie and I have been doing it here in the Bay Area for about 6 years.
Okay.
And now there's over 100 heart galleries all over the country, and we're actually just moving into Canada as well. But it's been a very, very effective tool for making connections between, you know, children and families. And in our heart gallery, we also focus on families who have adopted. So we really show diversity in families, so that when people think of adoption, they don't just think that it has to be a young heterosexual couple. It could be. So we show different single parent families, gay families, elder, you know, older families and older parents, and just to really put a face to adoption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have one of your heart gallery exhibits at the San Francisco Main Library?
We did, yeah.
I saw it. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Because it was really beautiful. And I love the writing that, you know, like the stories that were, you know, that were right there, the narratives next to the photographs.
Yeah.
Oh, that was really lovely. It's been a minute since I saw that, but when you would come, it's like, I think I've seen one of these. Cause
we've been traveling all over, like, for the past 6 years in all of the eight Bay Area counties, and it's really been a great project. So that's what was so interesting. All of my work had been with a lot of nonprofit organizations and working in a lot of indigenous cultures and impoverished areas. And so when I all of a sudden started thinking about the foot soldiers of the civil rights movement, it was so different than my normal, you know, day-to-day work or other projects that I've taken an interest in. It's it completely took me in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you like the direction that it took you in?
Oh, I love it. You know, it was such an incredible honor to spend the time that we had with Mr. Armstrong and to hear his stories firsthand and to, you know, really get to know this man who changed this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the others, you know, misses that you see in the film and many that you don't see in the piece that we did. So, you know, it's for me, it was a great honor to be able to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really great, you know, when you interviewed, Miss Amelia, who was 97, and she talked about how the policeman, he hit her, I know she said he hit her, like, behind her neck, and then he hit her again, and she fell, and I think there was archival footage of her falling and someone catching
her. Exactly,
yeah. I was like, wow, because he told her to run, and she said, why? Yeah,
right.
Like, wow, that was just amazing. And then the reverend that you were interviewing, Reverend C.T. Vivian, I believe?
Yeah, Reverend C.T. Vivian, yeah.
Yeah, and how he was talking about, that was really That was great. Talk about you know, some of these moments of this living history, and then maybe you could segue into your soundtrack. I just love the way you have these, because the soundtrack is almost like a character, because you know, you open with this song, and then
about,
go ahead, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say about voting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, we have music we felt was so important to that era.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'm going to just, before we go into the music, I just want to say Mrs. Boynton, who's now is 100.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, 100 in August, and she actually spent a week with us in this summer. We were having a we were at a festival in Washington, D.C. at Silver Docks, and we also had a number of screenings on congressional screenings on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to every single one of those. She was with us for a week, this 100-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she would every day, I mean, she would come dressed up with her matching shoes and matching purse and dress beautifully. And one day we were driving around Washington, D.C., and she's looking around and she goes, "You know, wow," she goes, "it's really changed so much since I was here in 1926.
Oh, my goodness, 1926.
1926. And then when I was making her reservation for her flight, and her birthday is August 2011, but it was 2011, 100 years ago.
Mm. Oh, wow, wow.
But she said something that really has stayed with me and really struck me when we were at these screenings. She said, and you know, she's you can see that she's got a lot of spunk in her when she says in the film, when she says, "You know, I didn't know if I should forget nonviolence and turn around and give them a sock in the face."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was funny.
What she said in Washington, she said, "You know, people are always saying to me, we stand on your shoulders." And she goes, and she says, and I tell them, "Get off my shoulders and stand on your own 2 feet." She goes, "I don't want anybody standing on my shoulders. You know, I want the next generation to stand on their own 2 feet." And I thought that was really important for people to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then I remember someone mentioning, and obviously it wasn't her, about sort of the lineage and how there was a long line of people sort of connected. And I don't remember the context of the quote, but it was, I don't know if it was passing it along, but anyway, it wasn't shoulders, but it was another type of connection. I don't remember. I didn't write that one down. But
Reverend Vivian, he's been with us at a number of screenings, also speaking. He's amazing. And I called him up to tell him after we got the nomination, and he was so, he now refers to me, he calls me Sister Friday. And he was just so excited. He just said, "This is groundbreaking." And
so we were listening to an archival interview with director Robin Friday about her film, The Barbara Birmingham, which was nominated for an Academy. Didn't get it, but hey, it was nominated. And this interview was back in February of this year. And we're joined in the studio by Professor Manuel Ampin to talk some more about the Save Nubia project. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm holding down the fort here and making things happen.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, I remember we had a conversation because you've done a lot of research around Martin Luther King Jr., right?
I have, yeah. I actually did my graduate work and my master's thesis is on the revolutionary Dr. King. And so I went to all of the archives around the country and looked through all of the primary sources to look at his political work and philosophy. So, yes. That's one of my areas of specialty.
Right, right, yeah. So you probably know this film, Barbara Birmingham. It was about one of the foot soldiers, and he used to cut Martin King's hair and when he would come through Birmingham. And, you know, really inobtrusive, but, you know, holding down the fort as, you know, as foot soldiers do. So, yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah, yeah. Would you describe yourself as one of the foot soldiers for African classical civilization and the preservation of our heritage? Because you have been, like, on the case. And
yeah,
you continue to be on the case.
You know, and that's what it takes. It's really to find an area of need.
Mm-hmm.
And many times when a person's moving forward, and this is what I found in my career over the last two decades, that when you are on the case and you're doing what you're supposed to do, you recognize that you don't necessarily choose the mission chooses you.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that actually from Dr. King, because he recognized, he finally accepted the fact that he had a particular role at a particular historical time. But he rejected that at first, because when he was launched into the movement, he was only 26 years old. So it took him some years to finally accept his role as a national and international leader, and he finally got to that point. But and I learned from that. I learned from that. And so, yeah, I've had to be on the front lines, because no one else has been able to or will do the specific work that I have to do and that I've been chosen to do. So, yeah, you know, being a pioneer and foot soldier is a part of the territory. So I'm always excited, because that's what we all have to do, is find our niche, our mission, and fulfill it to the best of our ability.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And now, you know, now there's a crisis that's imminent, you know, and so your work has taken the form of, you know, the Save Nubia, Ancient Kush project, and there's an event happening this weekend, October 13th, from 3 to 6 at the Lennon Life Gallery in San Leandro, 770 East 14th Street. Could you frame the problem for us, and what's going to happen if the money isn't raised and we're not able to stop this flooding?
Well, I appreciate that, the question, Sister Wanda. Basically, what's happening as we speak is that in Sudan, in the northern and central parts of Sudan, which is in northeast Africa, the Sudanese government has contracted with Chinese construction firms to build four new dams. And these dams are, in theory, to create hydroelectricity to allegedly help the local people live a better life. But that's not really the case at all. It's really to make money for those involved. And that's been shown. Because really they're going to export the energy to neighboring countries and not help local people. And this is what has already happened with the Marowei Dam. People were never compensated, never given a dime. Their lives are now worse off because they've been displaced from their homes. But if these dams are built along the Nile, several problems will take place. Not only will more than 100,000 Sudanese, including Nubians, will be displaced from their homelands without compensation and just be turned, their lives turned upside down, but there will be great ecological damage as well, because the Nile River, the longest living river system in the world, more than 4,100 miles long, will really be turned into a series of isolated lakes. So it will cause all kind of ecological problems. But my specific area of concern now as a historian and a primary researcher is that there will be countless archaeological sites that will be permanently flooded, because any time dams are built, all of the water backs up and create large reservoirs that could be hundreds of miles long, and everything is flooded in that flood zone. So there will be pyramid sites, temple sites, tomb sites, and ancient residential sites from ancient Kush and Nubia that will be permanently obliterated if these dams are built. And the local people, the local Sudanese, have been in opposition to it, because they know, they've seen the pattern of dam constructions in Sudan and southern Egypt that have not benefited the local people. So they've asked if we can help to amplify their voice to stop these dams, because there's alternative sources of energy that are available, such as solar panels, wind turbines, micro hydro, and these other alternative sources are used around the world. I mean, you look at the poorest communities in Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, and they're using micro hydro. They're using various other forms of energy that are renewable and are not destructive. So our goal really at the Save Nubia Project is to not only raise these issues, but to focus on getting these sites, these important archaeological sites, designated by UNESCO or the United Nations as World Heritage Sites under threat. Our other goal is we are having a fundraiser this Saturday, the 13th, to raise minimally $50,000 so that we can field a research team to go out for several weeks next summer and do the work of recording and documenting all of the historical sites in the area. And then third goal that we have is to help the local people in the Nubian region that will be flooded to build museums to help preserve their heritage and their culture. So that's really what's at stake here. We would be witnessing probably one of the most devastating destructions of world heritage sites and monuments than we can ever imagine if these dams are completed by the Sudanese government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we were talking about having this series of conversations, one of the things that I raised and you agreed that would be great to talk about this was how when the artifacts are destroyed, there a new narrative can be introduced and unchallenged because there's no evidence to counter it. And I thought you could frame what's currently happening in ancient Kush and Nubia within the global construct as it relates to African history and culture preservation and the importance of artifacts in light of a new Western narrative once the evidence is destroyed or, in this case, submerged or buried.
Yeah, that's a really crucial point, and a crucial concern here is that with the elimination of all of the original physical evidence, then it makes it much easier for those who are historical propagandists to turn the historical legacy upside down and introduce new images and replicas and new material to change the historical reality to a modern narrative to now make it seem as some non-Africans created this great culture along the Nile Valley and not only changed the look of the people, but also changed the nature of the artifacts themselves. And so this is a very dangerous pattern that is already in motion. I had predicted years ago when I first started writing back in 1994 the Vanishing Evidence series. This is a series of essays that I call The Vanishing Evidence of Classical African Civilizations, and I looked at the evidence that is vanishing in the areas of temples, tombs, and also museums, and where you have people that are deliberately destroying with the vicious stroke of the hand images and inscriptions that have been there for 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 years on wall materials. And I said that it seems clear to me that in these temple environments and tombs, with the images being chiseled away and plastered over, that it would now make it quite easy for people to reintroduce some new modern images and then take out all of the melanin or the dark paint on the original images and then make the images more generic and then change the nose and lip features so that when people see the images, they would never really equate them with African people, with black people. And that's exactly what is being done now at the Luxor Temple in Egypt. So right there at the Luxor Temple, if anybody goes, if they look, they'll see that the University of Chicago, they call themselves the Chicago House, has started to reintroduce these images, and now they're generic and they have nothing to do with how the original images look, because all the original images clearly had the paint representing dark pigmentation. Now they're just generic. So when I saw that at the Luxor Temple, I said this is exactly what was quite obvious of what they would do, because they already have doctored up many other images behind the scenes in museums, and this is the new story that's now being told, that these were not Africans. And even though we know that the areas we're talking about is squarely in Africa and always have been, so that's really the great, that's one of the great long-term problems that we have to be concerned about looking forward to our children and grandchildren and our posterity, that they won't even know if we don't do something about this, that this was a great African corridor from Kush being the oldest, then Nubia, and then Kemet. So there's been a vicious historical assault on the artifacts now for a number of years, and this is the latest effort to obliterate evidence of African high-level culture that represented the zenith and the apex of human achievement and math and science and social organization. And the evidence does not lie. It speaks for itself. So we can look at a number of areas where Africans have made unique contributions coming from the Northeast African corridor, representing the classical African civilizations of Kush, Nubia, and Kemet. So we cannot allow this new narrative to develop without challenging it and make sure that it does not meet its goal of de-Africanizing the area of that represents classical African civilizations.
Mm. Wow, yeah. I wonder if you could maybe paint for our audience just sort of, you know, when you talk about what's going to be lost, just maybe talk about what, give us more details about what that means, you know, first starting with the people and what will be lost to the people that are indigenous to this region. You know, what will they no longer have access to once, you know, the stories stop being told and there is no actual thing that people could point to sort of ground the story in a tangible reality, and then spin it out to the Pan-African diaspora and what that means for us, you know, with regards to, you know, our identity and what it means to be, you know, an African person, you know, in the diaspora.
Well, I appreciate the question there. You know, when I think about the local people in Sudan, and particularly in the northern region, I think about an area where there's a proposed dam at the Second Cataract, and this is the dam that's called the Dal Dam, D-A-L, and this is a projected dam that's going to flood a 40-mile area. And in the area, and visiting the Dal Dam area and location, it's rich with archaeological sites all over the area. And one place that we actually had a chance to travel to and use that as a base to record and document the area and meet the people is the village of Atab. It's kind of, it's a relatively small Nubian village. And we met Brother Ehab. And Brother Ehab, when we met him, we explained the project. He was referred to us by, mutual acquaintance, mutual contact person. So he didn't know us from Imhotep. So we visit him, and he takes us in for days. And Ehab dropped his schedule, and he would help to provide transport, practical support for us. And Ehab really summarizes the great loss in exquisite detail. We're able to interview him and get his comments on tape in the interview. But Ehab was saying, look, we don't want this dam, the local people, we don't want this because we're going to lose everything that we've ever known. And if somebody looks at the beautiful Nubian style homes with the beautiful painting scheme and the beautiful layout, all of that's going to be gone. So the homes will be flooded, and Ehab indicated not only their homes, he said our livelihood would be totally destroyed. He said, look, my father, my grandfather, my grandparents, they have introduced us to the Nile. They've lived off of the Nile. They said this is our home. This is the resource that we depend on for water, for transportation, for food, for fishing. This is our life, that the Nile is a living entity that we've always known. This is the only thing that we've known. And he said to lose this would be to lose one of the greatest resources that we've ever known. And then he goes on to say, Ehab, is that and he was very passionate about this, that it is, it's, you know, for them, it's also about the loss of their cultural identity, because their villages will be split up. People will go into these relocation camps that are unfamiliar to them, that don't have the resources, that now don't rely on the Nile. So he said that it'll be the loss of our cultural identity, and it also would be the flooding of the artifacts that we, or the monuments that we see every day and that we're proud of as Nubians, as people that are proud to be Nubians. That's one of the things I'm noticing. Nubians are absolutely proud, because even if they can't give the detailed historical account, they know that that's them. When they see those monuments and those artifacts, that's them. They take personal pride in being Nubian and claiming Nubian identity and being a Nubian community. He said that that's one of the most devastating losses that he and the other people can ever imagine. So when I think about the area there near the Dal Dam, I think about Ehab and his family, who are very hospitable to us. I also think about Dab Shambo and his family, that also the same thing. They took us in, didn't know us from Imhotep or from Amenhotep or anybody else for that matter, took us in as brothers. Brought the youth around to show me the specific sites that would be flooded, Kulama Island and those artifacts, and the people are just hoping that they could receive international support to help them preserve their culture. But there's so many families that we were able to meet at the second cataract, the third cataract, and the Kashbar area, where people had clashes with the police to stop these dams, and the people want support. But they are suspicious as well, because they don't know if people are coming in sending government agents to try to get a pulse of what the people are doing. But they're ready to defend their culture. Mm-hmm. And so they don't want to lose this. It's not just Nubians, but they're certainly among the most passionate groups in Sudan. There's the Manasir, who've been passionate about defending their territory, and other groups as well. And then so when we look at the larger picture of what this would mean, is that generally black folks in the diaspora, or here, let's just say in the U.S., we don't know as much as we need to know. So most people go back no further than slavery here in the U.S. And the great Kwame Ture said, if you start your history in slavery, the best you can be is a good slave. And that's generally what most people do. They just stop with slavery, and they discuss only things in the last few hundred years here in this country. They don't look at the larger historical picture, where basically people of African descent have been cut off from the origins of not only the origins of humanity, but also the origins of advanced civilizations that have laid the foundation for the world. So for us to be cut off from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean and embrace Africa and the contributions that come from the African continent would be one of the greatest psychological losses, historical losses that we can ever imagine. And nobody should ever discount the importance of having historical memory and being able to embrace the practices, the principles that allowed Africans to become great. So if we just simply look at how Euro-America and Western Europe, how they go back and embrace their tradition, how they love Greece and Rome. Every time we look at any field of study, it's always the Greeks, it's always the Romans, and they play. And those cultures play an indelible role and make an indelible imprint on us and play a indispensable role in the foundation of modern America, for example. I mean, you look at, you got elections going on now, but the Roman Senate is the direct foundation for the U.S. Senate. And if we look at any area of government, even our language, even the English language, 60% of it has a Latin base because the Romans brought Latin into Britain, and before the British came here to the U.S., no 10th grader, for example, in California can learn geometry without it being referred back to Pythagoras. This A squared plus B squared equals C squared formula, they incorrectly associated with Pythagoras. So there's no area, and by the way, Pythagoras went to Kemet, studied for 22 years according to his own Greek records, and he brought back to Greece a knowledge that he didn't have when he left Greece, because there's no teachers of geometry in Greece, there's no schools of geometry in Greece, there's no works, there's no literature, there's no information about geometry. The man leaves the country, they know nothing about advanced math, studies under African mathematicians and priests. 22 years later, now all of a sudden he's a so-called specialist in an area that he didn't even know existed until he left the area and studied under Africans. So you got, it should be the Amos theory, because Amos was the scribe that wrote on these mathematical papyri, the formula and all of the other advanced math. So, but anyway, the point is that, but Westerners, they want to embrace everything Greece, everything ancient Europe as the foundation for modern Euro-America. So we can't leave Africa just suspended in midair. We must anchor it to classical civilization in the same way other people have used that to build a modern culture and society. So we cannot continue to, those of us who are wallowing in this problem, but we cannot continue to suffer from historical amnesia and ever think that we'll solve our contemporary problems. And finally, it's not a matter of just going back to classical Africa and rebuilding pyramids today. That's not what I'm saying, but it's to take those principles that allowed them to build pyramid-based cultures that took organized society to a totally different level without exploiting people and without slavery, and provided a great model for not only us but any other groups that saw this high-level civilization. We need to take those principles and apply them today. So this was what would be lost by those in the diaspora, because we know our children are disoriented, misoriented. They don't know much about anything because they've been separated from this knowledge. And self-knowledge is the basis of true knowledge. And this is why we cannot allow our larger historical self, our larger historical contributions, to be minimized, dismissed, ignored, and destroyed. We need to embrace that so that we can move forward with the knowledge of what we've done in the world.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people, there's been a whole lot of information and misinformation about the Sudan. A whole lot. I mean, when one thinks about the Sudan, one thinks about Darfur, and the news has sort of just died off in Darfur, so it's like, is it peaceful there now, or is there still conflict? And then one thinks about the southern region of Sudan that is now its own country, and so what's going on there. Sudan is, I believe, the largest country on the continent of Africa, right?
Yeah, more or less. Well, now, you know, since it's been split, so now we got South Sudan.
Oh, right. I forgot it was split.
Yeah, but before that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but before that it was, before the southern Sudan became its own country.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Could you, in the next maybe few minutes, sort of bring us up to speed on sort of the socio-political, what's going on there now around, you know, in Darfur, in the southern region, and sort of the government structure, is there peace among these various regions now? As this really horrific plan is you know, you're trying to stop, is sort of moving along.
Well, you know, peace. The word peace in Sudan are really not synonymous in any way whatsoever. We got so many issues and problems, as you point out. Mm-hmm. Darfur has been happening for a while. This is in the west part of Sudan, and so the war in Darfur, that. The most intense aspect of it has died out, but there's still tension and conflict with the Darfurian local people in the Bashir government based in Khartoum. But the more hotbed regions now, over the last year or so, a little more than a year, are the Blue Nile State and South Kordofan, because in those areas now, the government is bombing, literally bombing these areas, and bombing the Nuba Mountains, for example, where the Nuba people live, in South Kordofan. So there's an actual war, a literal war, in those areas, because those areas, the Blue Nile State, South Kordofan, those actually now are groups of people that really represent the Sudanese people, the Liberation Army that is associated with the South. But since the split of Sudan last summer, now you have South Sudan as a new country, but the Blue Nile people and South Kordofan, they've been caught in the northern area, which is still Sudan proper, although their allegiance is to the South. And the problem has been in the South has been that the Bashir, Omar Bashir's government, they attempted to impose Sharia or Islamic law throughout the country. And the people primarily in the South, they're not Muslims. They practice traditional African religions, and also many of them are Christians. So they opposed, they rejected Sharia. And so now, so the conflict was over them not having a form of government imposed on them. And now that South Sudan is split off, it's even more intense now because they're fighting over border disputes now. They're fighting over oil fields, and they're also fighting over revenue of how much South Sudan should pay for the send oil to the oil pipeline. So they've been negotiating in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, to try to resolve these conflicts. But as of now, there's rebel groups on both sides that are fighting, so that the fighting in the South Sudan and Sudan is actually intensified. The area that I go to is really not associated with this because it's in the northern Sudan area and central Sudan. So it's more of an issue with people now trying to protect their rights, their environmental rights, and not be flooded. So who knows what can happen in the future? But right now, the real rich archaeological areas are not associated with the war and with the fighting.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent because one of the horrible things that happened when the former president George W. Bush bombed Iraq was that the American forces indiscriminately bombed all of the places where antiquities and wonderful artifacts were being kept. I mean, they just bombed all the museums.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's almost as if it really wasn't about oil. It was about changing the narrative, and eliminating the artifacts and the evidence to counter, writing didn't start there. It started over there. And so you lose, so all the books are destroyed. And so, one can say, so that the tree falls in the forest and nobody hears, did it really fall, literally.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's the same story over and over again. I mean, the
same
march
story,
of,
and you're right.
It's like, wow, imperialism just marching.
Relationship, and so it was really to bomb Iraq back to the Stone Age. And then, so whatever wasn't destroyed with U.S. bombing, then it was. Then we find that the looting that took place in the National Museum and other places was not random. This was organized looting because they knew the U.S. was going to come in to bomb, and so it was already organized plan because they had a international meeting in Paris to figure out what was stolen, what was the pattern. It was clear that when the United Nations came together, this was an organized looting operation, because how would an average person know the difference between a real artifact and a replica? They left the replicas and then stole the original artifacts, and then how did they even get a key to go down to the basement? So it was clear. Mm-hmm. And then clearly many U.S. soldiers carted off valuable items, and so those are things that take place. And that certainly would happen here, too, because of the richness of the artifacts in Sudan. Clearly, people would be very interested in stealing whatever they can and keeping it at keepsakes or making tons of money on the underground market if they can get their hands on these things.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah. And people don't realize that how interconnected, these stories are. And if one takes away, these valuable artifacts and erases this history, because you remove all of the tangible objects, it just really cuts off our humanity.
Yes, absolutely, because that's, artifacts are an expression of a people's culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they produce material items, those are objects that are expression of their cultural identity. And so that's exactly why during the vicious slave trade, not only were Africans stolen, but the artifacts were also stolen. So whenever there's war that takes place, there's a booty that's taken, literally from the people, but also the material objects as well. And that's always been a corollary to war, that material items representing the culture are always stolen and destroyed. That happens everywhere. We just had this ridiculous Columbus Day holiday. Same thing. Spanish come over, they destroy Mayan records, writings, because they figure that they're not there. So we needed to steal what we can and destroy everything else that we don't know about or respect.
Right, yeah. And we're speaking to Professor Maynu Ampin about the fundraisers for the urgent field research in Sudan. And again, that is this Saturday, October 13th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Lenin Life Gallery, 770 East 14th Street in San Leandro. Do you want to, in the closing minutes, sort of tell people what to expect at this sort of community forum fundraiser?
Yes, I appreciate it. Our event, or our organization, is the Save Nubia Project. And by the way, just the name, we call it Save Nubia because most people are more familiar with the name Nubia, even though they may not know any details, than they are of Kush. So our project is the Save Nubia Project, but it's really to save ancient Kush and Nubia. Our event this Saturday is at the Lenin Life Gallery in San Leandro, here right near Oakland, but San Leandro Lenin Life Gallery at 770 East 14th Street. So we'll be there 3 to 6 p.m. There's no cost. Our website is savenubia.org, and they also, a person can call 510-273-2456. That's 510-273-2456. There's no cost to attend the event. We want to get as many people there as possible, even though it is a fundraiser. And what we have lined up, we're going to have the editor of our 5-minute video promo, brother. He's going to be here to introduce his work, and then we have a brand new documentary that we are unveiling at the event. We're also going to unveil for the very first time accurate maps of Kush and Nubia. There's no accurate maps that have ever been produced, so we're going to unveil that. So after having people come and mingle, there'll be finger food and so forth. Then our agenda will be, we had a guy who believes in the program so much, he decided to sponsor it and, you know, use his resources to sponsor the event for us. And we'll have some testimonies by several people who have been consistent in supporting the project. We'll also have outdoor presentations so that people can know exactly what's at stake. We'll show slides of some of the artifacts, some of the areas, some of the Nubian homes, the other Sudanese homes that will be flooded, and what the historical significance of all of this means. And then we have some spoken word by Brother Paradise, and Sister Amna will be joining us for that as well. And we're going to have a huge turnout. So anybody that's coming, they really should come early. I'm sure we'll be at capacity. We start at 3. And then also, then it's a fundraiser. So we'll have a raffle. We'll have some items that we'll raffle off. And then we have different sponsorship levels so that people can contribute on whatever level that they can. And we have some very nice items. Like we already have, for example, our 2013 calendar out and available. It's very attractive. It's a pocket calendar / planner, so that's available. Our Save Nubia T-shirts, many different things. Our DVD documentary will be available, and our publications from the field work. So all these things will be available, and that will be at the end of the program for anybody that is able to, who wants to get any of these items. They'll be a part of the sponsorship package. And we'll also give people some gifts for coming, you know, like our Save Nubia notepad, so that when they're taking notes, they can always remember that we're focusing on Save Nubia. So I'm really excited about the event. It's going to help launch our work to the next level. And we'll be joined by other folks as well. We hope to have one of our Nubian colleagues who has recently reached out to say he's absolutely excited about our project. And if he's able to break away, then this would be a brother who also says a few words as well. So that's our lineup for this Saturday.
Oh, it sounds really wonderful. Sounds really great. Well, thank you so much, Professor Maynu Ampin, for joining us to talk some more about the Save Nubia or Ancient Kush project. And
Yeah, good luck this weekend with raising the $50,000 needed to continue the work.
Thank you, Sister Nubia. I'm sorry, Sister Wanda. Thanks
no
so much
problem.
For our work to help us with Nubia and with Kush. So.
Oh, I don't mind a slip. That's cool.
All right. Thank you so much.
You take good care.
Okay.
Peace and blessings. So we are going to conclude the show with another pre-recorded interview that was broadcast in, also in February, and it was an interview with one of the curators for the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is going to be, I believe, opening, I'm not certain if 2013 or 14, I'm not sure, but Paul Gardulo will tell you all about that, as well as you know, sort of the Bay Area connection to the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Wow, I was just, I'm so happy I had a little extra time to prepare because I thought I was going to go from one interview right into the next one. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm so happy that I was a little early because, wow, I'm really impressed. I mean, it's so wonderful. I guess it's about time, you know, that there was a National Museum of African American History and Culture. And what a fun job you have.
It is about time, first of all, overdue time. And yeah, I have the greatest job in the world. It's exciting, it's exhilarating, it is a huge challenge, and I feel the weight of the responsibility of the job as well. So it's exciting and humbling at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so tell us what you do. I mean, you are the one, you are the museum curator.
Well, I am a museum curator, so I'm part of a curatorial team.
Oh, okay.
that is working on building the collections for the National Museum of African American History and Culture, working on conceptualizing our inaugural exhibitions and working on curating those exhibitions, along with the programs and the other scholarship that we do. Because as we're going to open in 2015 and break ground just next week on the National Mall, the museum is already and has been fast running, well in business, doing exhibitions that travel around the country, educational and public programs and publications and a host of other things. And we've been doing that for, you know, nigh on 5 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wanted to let our audience know that even though the actual groundbreaking is by invitation only, people will be able to participate online. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're launching a social media initiative, and we're hoping to have find ways to bring that celebration out to a large number of people, both on the 22nd and then over time, so that we share the excitement as widely as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So people, all they need to do is go to the website. nmahc.si.edu/events/groundbreaking. And if the groundbreaking is going to start at 10 a.m. Washington, D.C. time, which I guess is Eastern time, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and that's going to happen on Wednesday.
Washington, D.C. has its own time zone. Sometimes I feel that way.
Oh, yeah, well, hey, why not? You know, capital of the United States, you can have your own time zone. Yeah, and it's going to be really cool. And that's going to be on Wednesday, the 22nd of February. And our president is going to give an address. And so that should be really neat. And it's really funny. President Obama is in San Francisco this week. Thursday, yeah. Uh-huh. And the tickets are kind of affordable. They're only $100. So the regular people can go see him.
Terrific. Well, and I'm hoping to be one of those regular people who catches a glimpse of him here in Washington.
Oh, well, you're like one of the curatorial team, so you got one of those chairs in the tent, right, with the heat.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at the vision for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we've got several museums and museum libraries dedicated to the history and culture of people of African descent. One is in Oakland, the African American Museum and Library at Oakland.
That's right.
And that's a new facility. And then we have another one that's even more recent, the Museum of African Diaspora.
Diaspora in San Francisco.
Yeah. And then at the African American Art and Culture Complex, there used to be, through the Negro Historical Society, a museum, but now they have an archive, and they also have and so they put on programs there as well. So and then I'm trying to think, and there's some other African American and African Pan African museums, like the one in, I believe, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big one in Texas, and so. You know, oh, and also, you know, people think about, you know, sort of the repository of African American history and culture. They think about the Schomburg, right, which is a collaboration
with the
New York public library system.
Correct.
So what's
and here in our own,
here
in my own hometown, we've got Moreland Spingarn Research Center at Howard University and the DuSable Museum in Chicago.
We can
call names all day, and I think that one of the crucial things to understand is that while the National Museum of African American History and Culture, while this is a real moment to celebrate and a real moment to recognize the importance of a national museum on the National Mall, that there are a host of institutions who have been doing this work in the for decades, doing this important work of showcasing African American history, and it's important to the importance to the nation or to their to its local community or to the region, all throughout the nation, and we really feel like in some ways we're standing on the shoulders of those kinds of institutions, like the African American Museum and Library in Oakland, like MOAD, and you know, even if they're new, and we're actively working to find ways to collaborate and partner with those institutions through our programs, and to be able to showcase the good work that they do and have done.
Mhm. Yeah. Now, I was just thinking when I was reading again, you know, going back to the vision, and one of the things that really sticks with me is, like, you know, the Sankofa complex, Sankofa. And I'm losing my train of thought here. But anyway, the Sankofa symbol, you know, insofar as going back and fetching it, and I'm thinking about the recollection and the reclamation and remembering, which I'm like, oh, that is so good. And then I was thinking about, you know, the national broadcast of the film Slavery by Another Name, you know, Sam Pollard, based on the book by Douglas Blackmun. And I was just thinking, like, 80 years after Reconstruction, 80 years. It's like 80 years. I mean, so I used to count, like, okay, we've been free, you know, legally for like 150 so years, okay. So, but then when you take 80 years from that, it's like, man, it hasn't been that long at all.
Certainly the legacies of enslavement are the legacies of slavery sit with our entire nation, and the history of slavery in its fullness hasn't yet been told on a national level to the entire nation, and the way that the legacy of slavery became entrenched in later histories has not been fully told, and we hope to be able to in our way tell a much fuller story, tell a fuller story of American history, and that's really what I think your notion of when you read our vision, I hope that's what one of the things that you're coming away with is that we really feel it's our mission to tell that broader American story for all Americans, and that to make it plain that the African American experience and that African American history and culture is central to understanding American history. That you can't understand American history in some ways without beginning with the African American experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that African American experience is a rich and diverse one. It is, it's an exciting and sometimes very difficult but crucial story to tell for all people.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, your notion of the Sankofa symbol is just right. That in order to, we can't understand where we are without looking back and knowing the road that we traveled on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and helping people remember these fuller stories, these stories that either people think they know,
mm-hmm.
or and getting reintroduced them to new ways, or introducing people to new stories that they've never heard of before. The history of African Americans in the West, for instance,
mm-hmm.
that goes deeper than the 1960s. That goes well before, you know, the migrations that World War II caused in the nation. That reaches back to the 19th and 18th centuries. You know, people who live out west, and African American communities who live there and have keep those memories, know those histories. But it's important for a national museum to be able to begin to tap into them and to begin to tell even a part of them, and to point to places where they can hear those, that story told in different venues and in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just love the way this vision, I keep on coming back to this, written. It says, in many ways, there are a few things as powerful and as important as a people, as a nation that is steeped in its history. Often America is celebrated as a place that forgets. This museum seeks to help all Americans remember, and by remembering, this institution will stimulate a dialogue about race and help to foster a spirit of reconciliation and healing. And then it goes on to talk about the four legs upon which this museum will stand. And it's like, wow, I mean, you do need four legs for something to stand if it's built like, you know, sort of a rectangular or square
right.
thing. It's like, oh, yeah, so that's like pillars. That's like, wow.
Right.
Yeah, it's just really wonderful. And then when I read further about who's building the museum, it's like, oh, that is too hot. So why don't you talk about sort of maybe, and then you could tell us about how the museum is going about, you know, your role of gathering these materials, these artifacts that might be, you know, in a family's possession or might be, you know, a part of an endowment that you're going to be the repository for.
Sure. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we've been, in some ways, this museum has been in process for close to 100 years. The idea for a national museum, a memorial, was on the National Mall, was created and proselytized by African Americans in around 1915, at a time when black veterans felt that their contribution and their memory to saving the Union in fighting for the Civil War, or in fighting during the Civil War, was being forgotten in an embrace of nostalgia and South and North reconciliation. And that movement kind of continued in fits and spurts in some ways, gaining interest and political power at some times, but always remaining a grassroots movement, you know, surfacing again in the late 1920s, and then really again starting in the late 1960s with the birth of Black Studies and the African American Museum movement, and then it really making it to fruition and getting signed in the 21st century into law by then President Bush. And so in some ways, this museum is a long time coming. But what's always been understood is by the people who were part of this movement was the crucial histories that a place dedicated to African American history could house, and the very precious histories that it needed to hold. And so the work I do right now, a lot of it is dedicated to going out and identifying the stories and the collections and the artifacts that we're building the museum for and to hold. And sometimes those are incredibly small but very moving objects, and my job is to go out and in some ways to meet people around the country, to hear their stories, to listen to the stories of how they've treasured items in their family for generations and would love it to come to the National Museum. Sometimes it does come from collectors who have taken time to recognize and collect on African American history for decades, but often, more often than not, it's also about just having a conversation about the importance of this history, the importance that it needs for all people to preserve and save and share these memories, either through stories that they tell or through caring for the photographs that are in their homes, or for caring for an old quilt or clothes that were passed down from generations past and might be tucked away in a closet or in a trunk somewhere. Papers and letters that were held and written by your grandmother or grandfather. These are the kind of things that are in people's homes, and this is the kind of a conversation that the National Museum wants to foster about the importance of sharing these precious treasures and saving these precious treasures and caring for them so that they can be known for generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when one thinks about museums and collections, for the most part, a lot of times when I go to the museum and I see an exhibit that's speaking to my experience as a person of African descent. In this hemisphere, Black people don't own the contents of the museum, you know, exhibit. It's usually owned by other people. And what's really nice is when one can attend, you know, one can go to a museum or to an exhibit in a gallery and see that this exhibit is owned by Black people, you know, because there's something to be said about how one values one's legacy when one own, you know, when one possesses the documents and the artifacts that illustrate that particular history or story. And what's really nice about currently, we're talking about MOAD, their current exhibit is called Collected Stories of Acquisition and Reclamation, and all of the collectors that are featured in this particular exhibit are people of African descent. So it's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the African American collector movement, and I'll call it a movement for lack of a better word, has mm-hmm. been a very interesting and story of the past of the past 25 plus years, and the recognition that, you know, saving this history and stories of this culture begins at home is a very important one to tell. And I think that what's important is not just a question of ownership, but a question of sharing. I mean, ownership is important, and I mean, you know, I think Billie Holiday wouldn't have written her famous "God Bless the Child That's Got His Own" if ownership wasn't important. But what's important is taking the stories and sharing them and making sure that people know. And I think that's a hallmark of the Black community as well. And I think that, you know, when we exist as a museum, and when we talk about the Smithsonian, you know, we really are talking about holding things in trust for the American people. And I think that that is so crucial, that we're now talking about building a national collection as seen through the lens of African American history and culture, that is of the African American experience, but in some ways is for all people to see how this history has shaped all of us. And I think that that is a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And that is such an important message for our country to hear and for the world to hear.
Yes, certainly, certainly. The museum is for, you know, all people, you know, all Americans and, you know, visitors to learn more about, in a comprehensive way, sort of the African American experience. However, a lot of times when the person that's being depicted in the artifact or in the story or in, you know, the collection of whatever it is, if the African American, let's say we're talking about African American artifacts or whatever, sometimes when they leave the community, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see it anymore.
That's right.
So that's why I'm saying it's good. You know, I'm glad to move.
No, absolutely. I hear exactly what you're saying, and I'm agreeing with you and the notion that's why it's important for a museum like ours to not just be a good steward of this history, but to be working with institutions that can keep materials and stories in their communities, and working with even families and community groups on fostering that knowledge and keeping history when history belongs in a community, to keep it alive there. I think it's a really interesting balance, and I know this because I'm one of the exhibitions that I'm most closely working on is about the power of place, and it's really about demonstrating the rich diversity of African American history in all regions of the country. North, south, east, and west, and doing it by telling particular stories, intimate stories about communities in, you know, roughly a dozen places around the country. And that means really helping to shine a spotlight on some really cool stories,
mm-hmm.
but also shining a spotlight, and that means, you know, having some materials in the National Museum, but also helping to foster the way those stories are told in their sites, in those places, in those communities, not evacuating things, not taking all things away, but helping to foster a sense of history and remembrance within the communities themselves. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, and that is so important to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you mentioned the power of place, I thought about the black towns, and I thought about mm-hmm. the film Banished, you know, Marshall mm-hmm. Williams' film, and how so many black towns are memories,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they no longer exist as municipalities,
right.
And I thought about that and those voices that that no one hears because they don't know that they're there.
Right.
And then I thought about Hurricane Katrina. My family's from New Orleans in Mississippi, and
mm-hmm.
In Mississippi, all of my family lost their homes because that's where the epicenter of the hurricane was. And so those people that were like in Pearlington specifically, a lot of them they went to the NASA base, you know,
mm-hmm.
to seek refuge, and because NASA had been collecting some of the artifacts, everything that they had was saved, and like photographs and other kinds
mm-hmm.
of artifacts, they were saved, but everything that was in people's houses is gone. Yeah. So, and so, you know, it's really That's why Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke, and then the sequel.
Yeah,
and then the sequel.
They're so powerful.
Yeah, because those are the stories, just like, you know, we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really wonderful when you can hear the voices of the people telling their own history.
Absolutely, and in fact, when we were, you know, that's been a initiative of ours. Mm-hmm. As we had a multi-year. A collaboration with StoryCorps.
Mm-hmm. I saw that on your website.
And we had a collected, I believe, nearly 10,000 oral histories from people in StoryCorps Griot.
Wow.
That we're working with our designers to think of ways that these stories can live when the museum opens and live online and really give a voice to these histories and many of the objects that we'll be having on display. And in fact, we were in Oakland in 2007, where we collected I believe for 2 days over in Peralta Hacienda Historical Park.
Daughter and I, we recorded our story at
Peralta. Oh, you
Peralta
did?
Hacienda.
Great.
Yeah, Holly is a good friend of ours.
Oh,
Holly,
that is great.
Alonzo.
That's right. So, I mean, that was a wonderful, and that was, I believe, our first official program in the Bay Area, and it was just a wonderful introduction to people, you know, on the museum. Of course, some of us, you know, knew the history and have connections to San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley and the wider Bay Area. But that was the museum's first time that we got to kind of to put our stamp on things, and just a wonderful, wonderful couple of days. So I'm glad you participated in that.
Yeah, the Peralta Hacienda House is looking to get some funding to create an exhibit that uses these oral histories.
Right.
Yeah, in the as a part of the exhibit.
So, you know, just a good way for the work our museum does, you know, way back on the East Coast to have a life, you know, with you continuing, you know. So I think that those are the kinds of things we're looking to do, and we've got a wonderful initiative called Saving African American Treasures that travels around the country to communities where you know. I think my little shorthand for it is it's kind of like Antiques Roadshow, except what we focus on is the historical value of things, not the monetary value of items. But what we ask for is people to bring their treasures to us, to curators and conservators, and we give advice about how to care for them, and we take information about the stories and add it to our notes, and if something is of what we think is of regional or local importance, we might recommend that they consider donating a material to an institution like the Hacienda House or like the African American Museum and Library, or if we see something that's, you know, truly that we think is of national importance, we might kind of say, hey, when the family is feeling like it, give us a call. Let us think about whether the National Museum is a place for this item. But it's really mostly about sharing stories and about learning how to care for your things. And we hope that that the Bay Area and certainly the West Coast is going to be a stop sometime soon for that program. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking we didn't mention the wonderful African American Museum in Southern California. It's
CAM.
Really. They do some great programs. Oh my goodness.
They sure do.
Yeah. Really.
They sure do.
Yeah. I was looking at your bio, and you've curated some pretty high profile exhibits and catalogs, you know, and the top 10 African American nonfiction books. In 2009, I'm talking about the Sherlock Studio and Black Washington picturing the promise, January.
Yeah, the Skurlock Studio. That was a wonderful show that got us connected to the Washington, D.C. community. The Skurlock family of photographers was, you know, one of the, in some ways, one of the best portrait photography studios in America for quite a while of time, and they photographed anyone who is anyone in the African American community, but not just limited to the Black community, who came to D.C. So you know, all, and D.C. was one of the was the capital of Black America in some ways from the late 19th century really until the 1920s when Harlem, you know, took hold, and then Chicago. But the Skurlocks were the Skurlock collection is a fabulous national treasure, and it gives a window into African American life in D.C. and really paints a national and international picture with some incredible photography of people and events and churches and schools and baptisms, and it's just it was just a wonderful pleasure and a great way for our museum to introduce ourselves with our first exhibition in a new gallery at in the Museum of American History. And it was our sort of belief that we, you know, we've got to remember where we're from. We've got to begin with D.C. And but these kind of Black photographers and photo, you know, photo studios were something that was national. And, you know, Oakland has its own E.F. Joseph, who came a little while later, but, you know, began his career, I believe, in the 1940s. You know, and photographed things like the ship welding and shipbuilding over in Richmond, as well as Oakland's nightlife, and a tremendous tremendous visual archive of material, some of which is in institutions and some of which is still held by private collectors who are doing a great job of caring for that history. But just another wonderful window into a place and time that isn't known by a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, when you were speaking about a current exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and it's called Question Bridge, Black Males, the mm-hmm. Blueprint. I'm pretty sure you're aware of it. And I know you know Deborah Willis and Hank
Willis. I do, and that's done by her son, Hank Willis Thomas. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's one of the smartest exhibitions and ideas that's come out in a while. Really, really important work on gender, on identity, on Black identity, and what it means, and the complexities of Black identity, and just so smart. I can't say enough about it.
Yeah, and remember when Deborah curated that wonderful exhibit that traveled the country, because you mentioned that, you know, Smithsonian exhibits travel, and one of the exhibits was looking at 100 years of African-American history, and it started with, like, you know, the small daguerreotype photographs.
That's right.
And that was at the African-American Museum and Library. And then at the Oakland Museum, there was another aspect of that particular exhibit. And then at Mills College, there was another part. It was like three. It was put in three different areas. I can't think of the name of it, though. What was the name of that?
We had one. Deborah did a show for us that was Let Your Model Be Resistance.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that was at Mills College. Okay, here.
Yeah, that was our museum's inaugural, and it's still traveling the country.
Really?
Of course, Deborah is yes, it is. It's still traveling the country. And, of course, Deborah Willis is an incredible scholar and is a prolific scholar and has a number of things out, so I'm not exactly sure which one hit you, but the one that she has done with us is called Let Your Model Be Resistance. It has and it has a life and it's an incredible series of searing portraits of African Americans over a 100-year period of time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And continuing on in your your exhibits, I was looking at you have you were curatorial advisor on O Freedom, a new website teaching African American civil rights through art at Smithsonian, and that you earned your PhD from George Washington University, and you were postdoctoral fellow at Yale University's
Gilder Lehrman Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Freedom,
Resistance,
and Abolition.
Yeah, and you're working on a book now on the subject of slavery in American cultural memory. I am so looking forward to reading that.
I'm looking forward to writing it. My work with the museum takes precedence, but but that is a subject that I think is important to me and is an important subject of study. So, but the work I'm doing right now in building this museum, both from the collection standpoint and from the exhibition standpoint, is more than I could hope for at the current moment.
Mm, yeah, I mean, it's like a dream job, huh?
It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So, in our closing moments, I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, about the architect who is African. I think that's so cool. And
correct.
That's on purpose,
yes.
Right?
well, we had a design competition, and this was a couple years ago, and the team that was selected was a combination of three different firms, architectural firms. David Ajay, who is a Ghanaian architect. He's a young guy. He's a really rising star. He was born in Ghana, grew up in Tanzania, and makes his home in London. So he's in some ways like, you know, an Afropolitan young guy who's a visionary, has designed an incredible museum for us that reaches back to his West African roots in a sort of gesture of praise and celebration. You can see the images of the design images of the museum on our website. And he has worked, he has wonderful collaborators. He works with the Phil Freelon Group, who's an African-American-based architectural firm out of Atlanta. And then Max Bond, who's no longer with us. He passed away a couple of years ago. But Max Bond's firm was in some ways the Max Bond was the dean of African American architecture, and so our group is Freeland Ajay Bond, and we are so thrilled to be working with them. They beat out an impressive crew of other internationally renowned architects, and we're so thrilled with the vision that they bring to the museum, one that is forward. Forward thinking and yet rooted in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all I could think was Ujamaa.
Ah.
Cooperative economics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, keeping the money in the community. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your impressive. Oh, and I wanted to mention that the exhibit that I couldn't think of the name of is called Reflections in Black, A History
yes.
of Black Photography, 1840
yes.
to the Present.
Correct.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about your museum council and your impressive scholarly advisory committee. Like, oh my goodness! I mean, Dr. John Hope Franklin is
That's
at the top
right.
of the list.
Right.
He's no longer with us physically, but hey, his energy is so here.
I'd be happy to. The museum council is a body of impressive people who are charged with really, you know, making the museum happen from the ground up in terms of they bring the notoriety, they bring their skills as, you know, business leaders and entertainment leaders to the table in a number of ways. Because as you know, this is a long range, very high profile, very expensive project. The museum Museum Scholarly Advisory Council is the group of people who I really know as one of the scholars in the museum, as a curator. And this is just the most amazing group of scholars you could ever wish to hope for, working with, you know, really people who had taken their lead from John Hope Franklin, who was, you know, in some ways my hero, who really was the preeminent American historian, I think, of the second half of the 20th century. Just a guy who is dedicated to telling the full story, like we began our discussion with that on that note. Somebody who wouldn't stand for less than the full story professionally, and yet he did it in a way with such class and with such personal grace. And I think his, not just his scholarship, but his attitude informs everything we do. The other people on that committee, from Deborah Willis to Dr. Janetta Cole to Taylor Branch, who wrote the magisterial series of biographies on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., to brilliant legal scholars like Drew Days, to physical anthropologists and like Michael Blakey, who worked on the African burial ground, among other things, in New York City. And they just bring such a wealth of knowledge and commitment to the table that we can't help but be inspired. But what is most important is that they bring such enthusiasm and such care and respect for those of us who are doing the work. Mm-hmm. And so, there are breaths of fresh air. We see them. We're in contact with them over terms, but we see them 4 times a year, and it's the best 4 days of the year when we see those guys.
Nice. Yeah, and I also want to mention Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Dr. Reagan I was a little intimidated to meet her, and she's become a good, not only a good mentor, but a wonderful friend. And I was intimidated only by her reputation and what she's done in her life. And when you get these folks in a room, you know, it can be a little daunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then going back, I just want to do a couple of name drops, because it's like, ooh, wow, Oprah is everywhere. Oprah is a part of the Museum Council.
That's correct.
And Quincy Jones is as well. Like, wow,
yes,
how diverse.
Absolutely.
As well as the usual, you know, people who are connected to money. They're there as well. Wow, this has been really fantastic, and I hope we can have another conversation in the, as the museum is built, you know, you can sort of like let me know. We can maybe talk about, okay, well, you know.
I would love to, and we'd love to stay in touch as if we know when we're going to be coming to the area.
Nice.
It'd be wonderful to meet you. The last time I was in your neck of the woods was 2010, where I had some great meetings with people about potential collections, and we collected a couple things, and we'll be doing more of that. So it would be wonderful to stay in contact with you as the time
progresses. Super. What did you collect, and from whom did you collect it?
Well, the one great story that I could tell you about is a few small things, scrapbooks really, from a woman named Frances Albrier, who was a civil and equal rights activist and leader. And she had moved from Alabama to California as a young woman in 1920 and began nearly 6 decades of civil rights activism from her Berkeley home. And she worked as a nurse, and she was a union organizer, and she ran for city council as Berkeley's first African-American woman candidate.
Wow.
She got involved in voting drives and fair employment practices in the 40s, and she was the first black welder, can you believe this, at the Richmond shipyards. And she also then moved into history, and she created the first Negro History Week displays in Oakland, and I believe some of her work is still in the African American Museum and Library in the 1950s. And so we were able to collect from her family a couple of scrapbooks that were dedicated to her work on voter registration and on her travel internationally. And just a wonderful connection and a wonderful story that we can showcase in the museum. You know, a lot of people know the history of the civil rights movement in the South, in Mississippi and in Alabama. Not enough people know about it, but it's well known and well documented. But when you get into stories like this, we'll really be able to open some eyes to visitors to the National Mall. So we're thrilled about that.
Oh, that's great. Well, my students are waiting for me to go to class.
I'll let you go.
But it's just really wonderful that, you know, the museum, the National Museum, is going to be a place where we see ourselves. Like, we see ourselves generally, but we'll see ourselves specifically in the collection and in the various programs that are there. So it really will be a place where we can really come together and maybe it might be a place, and it might be a first start in sort of, you know, healing that rift, which I think is a part of the mission, and in helping African people that have been dispersed come back together.
I hope so. Well, it was a great time talking to you. I'd love to do it again sometime.
That'd be lovely, and wow, have fun next Wednesday. We'll be watching
online.
Thank you
very much. All right. Take good care, Wanda.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.